When it comes to relationships, our culture in recent decades has begun to de-emphasize the importance of marriage and family. The sexual revolution has negatively impacted these God-ordained institutions by influencing young people to believe sex outside of marriage is the acceptable norm, and that mindset leads adults to take less responsibility for children and, therefore, an increase in abortion. Let's get rid of the problem. Welcome to Refocus with Jim Daly, a podcast production from Focus on the Family. On today's episode, Dr. Mark Regnerus will encourage you to stand for truth, God's truth, and help you as a Christian to avoid falling prey to a secular mindset that often ignores God's design for us as men and women. Dr. Regnerus is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin, and he's researched and written about numerous social topics like marriage, parenting, and abortion. His findings have led some progressive students and college faculty to criticize him and try to cancel him, get him revoked, pretty much. But he has always tried to respectfully resist their attempts to stop him from researching and writing about the importance of the traditional family and basically writing about what he's seeing in the research. Today, you're going to hear an intriguing discussion I had with Mark recently. He offers some brilliant insights and does a great job of speaking truth, and there's so much we can learn from him. A couple of thoughts. One, just the research that he's done. This is based in empirical data. He's getting the feedback, collating that and putting it together in his research findings. So one thing that faith, I think, demonstrates is that it's working in people's lives. And as Mark does that research and solicits answers from thousands of people about how they're doing and what the cause of sexuality in society is doing to them, he's compiling that. And guess what? Oh, it lines up with Scripture. And as Christians, we shouldn't be surprised. It's just unfortunate that Mark has taken it on the chin from his academic colleagues because it doesn't line up with what they want to project. I hope you'll listen carefully as I unpack these issues with Dr. Mark Regnerus on Refocus with Jim Daly. You know, for background, again, you're a university professor. Tell us a bit about your discipline and what you've been doing the last 20 years.
Yeah. it's been 20 years exactly since I've been at the University of Texas at Austin. Professor of sociology, dabbling in debates that are easy to get into hot water on, marriage, family, sexuality, gender. So I've been there for 20 years, and I'm also a senior fellow at the Austin Institute for the Study of Family and Culture, kind of a research nonprofit in Austin, keeping alive sort of vital discussions about things that in some ways people don't want to talk about anymore, and we have to revive them.
You know, Mark, let me ask you this question, because people, we all do different things. So your day-to-day life, you know, you're on the important things, I would think, you're creating research, shaping research, how do you get to the data, and reporting on the data. Following you from a distance, I know there's been some things that you've done that, boy, you've gotten incredible pushback on. And I'm sitting here going, he's a social scientist. I mean, he's going out interviewing people that are giving him information, and then Right. You're reporting the data.
Right. Yeah. It gets complicated.
You know, everybody accuses you of spinning this or spinning that.
Yeah.
How do you spin something that's just so straightforward as data?
Right. So I tend to think that I do far less spinning than my opponents or critics do, partly because the way I approach basic survey data is by telling a story and you grow from simplicity towards complexity. Mm-hmm. So back in 2012, with the study of same-sex households with same-sex attracted parents and their children, how they fared over time, that got me in a lot of hot water. But what was problematic from my opponent's position is that I started with a basic description of what was going on in those households, right? And what their mother or their father was like and did, etc. And then I built from there towards a more complex story of, well, what happens when you control for this thing and for that thing? And frankly, a lot of the dispute in this domain is about how do you tell the story? And my opponents, they want to always leap from the simple. They don't want to talk about the simple differences because the simple differences are almost always there,
right?
They want to go to complexity quickly, right? And control for household instability, for poverty, for all manner of things that we know affect children, right? But in terms of household instability, for example, it is a key means by which you see differences in same-sex households versus opposite-sex households. So if you rush to complexity, you can probably tell whatever story you want.
Hmm.
If you start with the simple and build and tell the story of it all, you will see significant differences between children who grow up in same-sex households and opposite-sex married
households. Let me ask you, you know, because it's interesting, and I hope people, Christians particularly, are interested in that data. What are just some of the large bullet points from that study that you saw, the impact of children from a same-sex household versus a two-parent heterosexual household?
Right. So I have to go back in my mental database 10 years ago. One of the things that we saw back then, and that was kind of an earlier generation of same-sex households for which I was criticized, the parents were typically not in a kind of coupled same-sex relationship with the child in the household for very long. Far more likely to be mothers than fathers. That's still the case today.
Mm-hmm.
But even when you had two mothers in the household, the odds that they stayed together for the entire time the kid was growing up was really low. So you fast forward to today and people will say, well, that's not being raised by a same-sex couple. Well, it's spending time in their household for sure, but it's also experiencing the sort of high and almost endemic breakup rates of two women in a household, right, in a romantic relationship. That's still the case today.
Mm-hmm.
You go to the European data and our American data, which is, you know, better than it was 10 years ago.
Right.
You still see the, you know, the instability rate double for sure. We're past the debate about same-sex households with children in the United States, so nobody cares anymore.
You know, it seems to me, and I've written about this in my own blogs and other articles I've done, there seems to be, and this is, you know, maybe inflammatory language, but I'm trying to make the point. There seems to be just a general war on children. And when you look at the deficit that a child starts with in that environment, you quickly realize it's not about the child. It's not about the child's welfare.
Right.
It's about our home and what we're trying to project, and we want to be good parents and, you know, all those right things. But we, again, fail the kids.
Right.
It's like we're constantly failing kids in this culture.
From the get-go, I mean, how does one acquire a child, right? So who has the right legally to acquire a child? How much does it cost? We start thinking about this in terms of how same-sex couples acquire children in a way that is acquisitive and legal, right? And sort of has deals with rights quickly, right? Distinctive from how still the vast majority of children come into the world as the product of the love of their mother and father. So, yeah, from the get-go.
It's tough.
It is.
And it's unfortunately, it's such a me-focused culture that we don't lay our lives down for our children. And I don't care where you're coming from in your worldview or your politics or anything like that. We have failed to put kids first and to understand what they need to give them the best environment possible over our needs.
Right.
Right. And I don't care what environment that is. That's a selfish heterosexual couple that divorces creates problems for those children as well. Let's move to modern day.
Okay.
That was 2012. Okay. And I'm sure, does that research continue? You're still looking at that
I'm not looking at same-sex households anymore, although I am keeping track of who is and what they're saying. One of the things that I do now a bit more than I used to is, well, there's not a lot of time, right? One person, lots of stuff going on. But as the comfort level of data collection on that topic has increased, post-Obergefell, you know, my life became easier because people weren't hounding me and hassling me anymore. They, in terms of my opponents on, in terms of research, have become, you know, more transparent. So I can just read studies and still see the effects of what I was talking about in 2012.
The basic premises were true, right?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, right. Instability remains extraordinarily high. Yeah. But if you control for instability, you can make the kind of baseline difference between same-sex and opposite-sex go away. But that's such a major thing in kids' lives. And then I think about, well, as a person who's trying to tell a story of how life happens, what does it mean when I sort of control for some major influence in a child's life, right? And what does it mean to sort of control for anything, right? Like, is life lived in pieces where, like, well, the female part of a person would predict this, but their age would predict that? It kind of is somewhat dissatisfying as a social scientist to sort of think about, like, what is it we're doing when we're chopping people up into variables? And yet that's what we do. But this is why I've always liked going back to sort of, well, what's the baseline story, right? With these kids, how are they faring, right? Before deciding, okay, now let's build a complex statistical model by which we can clarify some things and mask other things.
Yeah. And I guess the bottom line, it shouldn't be a shock that what we as Christians believe is God's design for humanity to marry, to be fruitful and multiply, have children, and to live monogamously with one another, that ends up being the best blueprint.
Right.
And there's lots of people that don't agree with that blueprint. They attack us every day. You know that.
Yep. Yeah.
And, you know, yet the data over and over again continues to show that children fare best in that type of household.
Yep.
Right?
And this is still the truth.
It's still the truth. And that's what, you know, I guess long term, I'm just worried about manipulation of those things that, you know.
You should be.
Different people.
Because they are being manipulated.
Yeah, different groups decide, okay, now we can game the system. This is what we want to tell them. This is our experience. And then the data is going to be worthless, right?
Right. When you think about sort of the politics around this stuff and like creating legal and pseudo rights, using data to tell their story. Oh my goodness, data is manipulable, and you can probably tell whatever story you want if you go about building a model in a particular way and getting your peers to buy off on it.
Right.
So it's very frustrating from my angle how the story of people's lives, the story of sort of process, normal social processes are kind of hijacked by a large group of progressive social scientists who are pre-committed to particular ends.
Yeah. In that regard, you know, I think many of the Christians I know that watch college campuses, university campuses, we call it social sciences, but there's an awful lot of social reengineering going on in there.
Yeah.
They're looking for their outcomes to prop up a certain type.
Correct.
And that is no longer science, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's always been a progressive discipline, sociology.
That's quite nice. Such a progressive discipline.
But I'd say in the last 5 to 10 years, it's been kicked up a notch still.
Yeah.
Students who are coming into it, I teach social research methods, and there's some of them don't really want to learn standard old school research methods. They're more interested in telling certain stories.
What do you think in terms, and again, I don't want to put you on the spot so you can decline this, but because you're in that environment, but university campuses to me just seem so woke. I mean, that you can only speak about things a certain way, you use certain terminology. It's such an anti-critical thinking environment to my sense.
Yeah.
But I'm not on campus anymore. I did my MBA. We didn't deal with a lot of the stuff you deal with in social sciences in the business school. But, I mean, speak to that environment.
Yeah.
It seems anti-intellectual.
Right. It varies place to place. So we're treated to a lot of sort of the horror stories that are going on out there. Some of it depends on how vulnerable people feel. Now, I will say, tenured, established, well-paid, full professors across the country now feel like the students run the show, right? And those faculty tend to be a lot more skittish than they used to. So there's definitely something to it. At the same time, You know, you won't find a more kind of group of sort of herd mentality than you'll find of these tenured full professors. They don't want to mess up the good deal that they've got. Exceptional deal, frankly. And so they don't want to raise a ruckus most of the time. Mm. But they do have the protection of tenure and intellectual freedom and can do so, okay? But there are more than one ways to bleed a person, right? So, you know, I came under all sorts of scrutiny back in 2012 and shortly thereafter, navigated it. But, you know, there are other ways that they bled me, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but I still think that adjuncts, term professors, those are, you know, that's a more vulnerable. You know, just
right.
It takes an administrator to say, nope, your contract is up.
If you don't dance to the tune, you're right? out the door.
So that's a tougher spot to be in.
Yeah.
At the same time, I don't fundamentally change my message, and I've kind of stopped being bothered by people.
Yeah,
partly
which is
because
good.
They recognize, like, okay, we've taken the hammer to Rignaris, and it didn't work.
Right.
So I think one can get on the backside of it, but you always have to kind of monitor and pick your battles and things like that.
Before we move on, then let's dig into that. You were kind of at the beginning of cancel culture. You may have been one of the first people that really took the blows in that cancel culture mm-hmm. situation.
Right.
Because of the research, because of what you said about same-sex couples and the children that aren't thriving in that environment, and they pummeled you. But you survived. You're still a professor. You're still at University of Texas. How did you do that? And then what insights do you have for others in the culture
right.
that are under the thumb of the cancel culture?
Right. So a couple things. You know, I'm grateful to the grace of God and the help of the church for coming alongside me. And that was helpful. Now, some of the sort of prudent things I elected to do was I didn't push this on social media. So I think that was helpful. I initially started trying to sort of put out some fires with people, and then I decided, too many fires, right? So
yeah.
I'm just going to shut down. And I thought, okay, I was going to write a response article to this. And so I just kind of almost went off grid for a while, not quite, to hunker down and write. Now, one of the positive side effects was of that that the media timetable is such that they don't stick with you for very long before moving on. So if you are fueling the fire about yourself, that's not good, right? Mm. So you want to sort of drain that of energy, drain that of oxygen. So don't talk, right? Stay off social media in that sense and just kind of hunker down. If there are administrators you need to sort of kind of clarify with, be kind, but be firm, and do not ever apologize for something that you didn't do wrong, right?
Boy, that's such a good point. And I think that's where so many people make the mistake.
Yeah.
Just to get them off my back, I'll just say I'm sorry.
It doesn't get them off their back.
And then
they smell
climb
blood
on.
In the water,
yeah,
and
exactly.
they think, okay, he admitted he did it wrong. Let's go for the administrators and get him to shut him down.
You could probably pull about a dozen of those truths right out of Proverbs that you applied if you go in and read Proverbs from a cancel culture,
exactly.
social media context. There's ancient wisdom in there that right. would really apply. Let's move forward now. I mentioned that a minute ago, but the Dobbs decision, which overturned Roe versus Wade, which simply put everything back to the states. I mean, everybody, you know, some people thought,
right.
well, okay, that ends abortion. And not really.
Right.
It
right.
puts it back in the decision-making capacity of each state to make that decision. But you study dating, marriage, and sexuality, and you follow these things, and you look at the, I guess as a layman, I'd say the ripple impact
yeah.
of these kinds of Supreme Court decisions. Mm-hmm. What do you think the impact will be on abortion numbers and kind of relationships generally?
Yeah. It's going to be murky. The abortion numbers, obviously, they should diminish some. However, attention may be redirected towards sort of earlier detection, you know, Plan B, that sort of thing. So I expect kind of that to rise in
mm-hmm.
Attentiveness. You have your kind of abortion tourism companies paying people to go to other states. That may have kind of an early energy, but I don't think it has a long-term sustainable energy.
Yeah, let me ask you this. Yeah. You're a thinking man. You're an intellectual. You teach at university. That's the context mm-hmm. I'm asking you this question. Why do companies, I haven't figured this out, is it my background in business, why would a company support the elimination of the consumer base of the next generation?
Right. Yeah.
It seems so illogical.
It does seem illogical.
That they would support those things. Right. I mean, Disney supporting abortion is just bizarre to
me. Yeah, exactly.
Do you have any idea?
Well,
Is it just pressure?
I don't think they plan on sort of a 30 to 50 year kind of market orientation. Or if they do, they're banking on sort of a pretty different sort of social scene in the future, higher immigration, things like that, which we probably should bank upon. So they're probably saying, okay, our market isn't going to be large, but it will be consistent via other means besides birth. So we can, I think they obviously don't think they're harming their downstream revenue.
Yeah,
much,
which is bizarre,
right? Which means that there's got to be some degree of positioning and jockeying and kind of signaling that they think will be good for business in the near term. I don't know if it is.
But the bizarre thing, the bottom line, you take 63 million customers out.
Yeah,
that makes an impact.
Right.
I would think business would be as pro-life as the church. for that reason,
right?
Just economic livelihood.
Yep.
Not a conviction, a religious conviction of any kind, but you would think they'd work in their best interest.
Yeah,
it's just kind of weird to me.
When you see sort of the dynamic now about sort of green energy and environmentalism, et cetera, which is not inherently a problem and probably a good idea, there's this kind of coalescing of, we need fewer people because we're the sort of the worst of the sort of the creators of excess carbon and things like that. So it's got to confuse companies to sort of say, hey, we want fewer future customers than we've had in the past.
Right. It's just illogical. So we'll leave it there. The impact of Roe v. Wade and now the reversal of that, just throwing it back to the States the way we've described. I can remember being a teenager. Actually, I was probably 11 or 12 when Roe v. Wade was passed. And I can remember friends of my brothers who got, girls got pregnant and they would talk about being in front of the judge and they had the choice of military or marrying her. A very different era,
Seriously.
I'm also thinking of the project, the family project we did where I think it was Ms. Green, who was a former feminist who became a committed Christian. And she said, we thought as feminists, and the sexual revolution, we thought we were getting acceptance, and what we actually got was abandonment, which is a powerful statement, right? So in the context of a post-Dobbs, are men accountable again for their sexual activity in some states, or, are there going to be...
Not that I see.
Not that you see. That's actually unfortunate.
There have been kind of initial sort of discussions about, men should be held responsible for the children that they create. It's kind of almost a joke because they're describing the sort of the frameworks of marriage, right, without wanting the real framework of marriage. But and kind of putting my ear to the ground about what's being said post-Dobbs, or after the Dobbs decision, I don't hear much about sort of male responsibility. You heard stuff about sex strikes, which is, it's rumor and it's probably, A, it's not going to be effective. B, it won't last. C, it takes a lot of women to actually make a dent in this. And the kind of cartel idea around women in the sort of wider mating market just doesn't exist anymore. That's just been busted. So I don't really see much going on around men. I see some going on around women. At the same time, that feminists are probably at face value the most irritated by this development. We have emerging this sort of question of, so what constitutes a woman, right?
Yeah.
So somewhere in there, women aren't even the primary group who's upset about the end of Roe v. Wade somehow. It's somewhat mysterious to me, but you look at the protests, I saw the protests going in front of the different Supreme Court justices' house. You're at least as more likely to see the rainbow flag as you are to hear any sort of assertions or statements about feminism from this group. So it really did not materialize in the way I anticipated. So I've kind of started doing some thinking about, like, so where are the women in this?
Where are the attitudes?
Men in this?
Yep.
And why is the LGBT community sort of stoked about this?
Why do you think?
Well, I think it has more to do with LGBTQ identity than we thought. Not necessarily because, oh, there's such pregnancy risks. Bisexual women are fairly high pregnancy risk because they tend to have risky sex with men in addition to some relationships with women. So you've got that. But there's some emerging social science using, I believe it's the General Social Survey, United States, good survey, out of a British social scientist looking at this, mapping the change in LGBTQ identification and its tight association with sexual behavior over time. It's getting much less tight. So what we have now is a coalescence around what is LGBTQ self-ID? It's coalescing around progressive women who exhibit or express some degree of depression and anxiety, right? But it has much less to do with sexual behavior, like as in homosexual behavior. Mm. Homosexual behavior is kind of declining as a key component of LGBTQ, which to a lot of us observers are like, that's odd, right? I mean, there was a time not so long ago when behavior was the primarily central distinctive factor to the LGBTQ movement,
right?
And the data is showing us that, well, if it was at one time, and it was, it isn't so central today. Well, what does that have to do with Dobbs, right? I think the most bitter reaction to Dobbs has come from this corner. It is about progressive women, anxiety, some depression, fairly educated, but like modally, they'd be heterosexual by behavior, right? And so there is a pregnancy risk because more LGBTQ identified persons are actually in heterosexual relationships than we think. So it's somewhat of a mystery. And I dove deep into it after Dobbs came out. I'm watching the protests. I'm thinking, this is not what I was expecting.
Interesting. Especially from a social scientist. I mean, these are the things you watch and study.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about marriage in general, moving away from
sure.
that more controversial end of family formation. But we look at marriage. I think the age was 25 to 34. Those that are married, men that are married in that group now is 34%. In 2005, it was 50%. That's a pretty dramatic reduction in
yeah.
family formation and
yeah.
marriage. So again, as a social scientist, right. when you look at the importance of marriage for the culture, and you see right. such an incredible decline in young people, 20 to 35, willing to get married,
yeah.
A, is that accurate? And B, what's the outcome of that?
Right. Yeah, it is a percentage point decline per year for at least 40 years in terms of the share of men who are married in that time frame between 25 and 34, which is kind of a sweet spot in marriage. And so if you think about that, the fewer that are marrying, and once you hit 33, 34, 35, the interest in marrying sometimes it will begin to decline rather than increase.
Right.
So it's a balance, right?
Right.
So lots of us have 40-something-year-old male friends who they kind of would like to marry, and yet, boy, they are their independence has been sort of reinforced and reified over time. So, yeah, marriage is in full-scale retreat in the West. The deal is, when you look at the share of everybody who's married, it's declined, but it hasn't fallen off the cliff. What has fallen off the cliff in some ways is sort of the age at which people marry. In terms of, we used to expect it between usually 20 to 27, mm-hmm. right? And now it's like 29, 30 as the median, meaning half before, half after that. divorce rates have gone down, but I think they've stabilized. Gray divorce has increased. People divorcing.
Empty nesters.
Yeah. Right. Anecdotally, tons of that in my world, which somewhat befuddles me, right? Some of this, I think, is kind of a product of an economically successful society who decides we really don't have to do this anymore. We don't have to live. You can have your own house. I can have my own house. So some of it is a product of material well-being, right? This penchant for independence.
Let me ask you about this, because it's something that's caught my attention, that financially we've become so capable that we don't need the, what some would say, the old institution of marriage, right, which was necessary to lift people out of poverty and to, along with
still
education.
Still pretty helpful.
Yeah. I mean, that's the best, best form of fighting poverty. But again, let me go to some of these nuanced things that are being said, that somehow the nuclear family was a construct of Western Europe. I think it was Jesus who said a man will leave his mother and father and cling to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. These people,
right,
in your circles at the university that are saying nuclear family is a Western construct. Yeah. I mean, is that accurate?
It's a curiosity what they mean by nuclear family. So far as I can tell, people are criticizing to some extent the formation of separate households, mom, dad, children, separate from grandparents or something. Well, people have been doing that for quite a while. In the United States, we've been doing it for a very long time because, the country was wide open. People moved.
And there was a streak, and is a streak of individualism in the West. I get that.
Decided streak. Correct.
Yeah, let's get out of mom and dad's house because I'm tired of them telling me what to do.
But lots of people never minded grandma and grandpa living next door or down the street. So the kind of pushback on the nuclear family is somewhat misplaced, because none of us in the sort of marriage-friendly orbit are telling people to, kick grandma and grandpa to the curb or move as far away across the country as you can. We all know that extended family is really helpful for people, especially in marriage and child rearing. Like, we like grandparents around. Do they have to be, in the same house? Maybe. Don't have to be.
Well, it gives the impression, though, that women, all they want is a sperm donation. There's no need for a husband or a father.
It's ridiculous.
Right. I mean, but that's kind of the construct of these liberals that are trying to promote men are not that necessary. They're a little bit necessary.
I think I know where you're going or where the
the
kind of criticism of the nuclear family is criticism mostly of the biological family, right? What's nascent and rising in popularity, at least in intellectual circles, is sort of these families of construction, right? That, it doesn't have to be a biological connection. It doesn't have to be a spouse married civilly or religiously. We are constructing families in different ways. And if the legal systems were to protect us, we could do it just as well as anybody else.
Yeah.
At the same time, you're a father, I'm a father. Fathers care for their own children in a distinctively different way than they care for the neighbor's kids, right? Women have a little bit more generous love to them around children. But you move too far away from sort of father's responsibility for their biological children, it gets a little dicey. So even when we think about the construction of step families, we really ought to see step families as sort of, it's almost heroic when a father steps in and I'm going to raise you as if you're my own. Because it certainly doesn't come natural to a father's kind of genetic material and orientation.
Interesting. Yeah. I know, I can appreciate that. A lot of times when families are looking at adoption, oftentimes it's the dad who's saying, I don't know if I could love that child the way I love my other kids,
right?
And that's usually a speed bump for them.
It is.
And then often, especially Christians, when they they find that they can love them certainly enough.
Yeah. And so the move away from nuclear family that's going on at present is about kind of criticizing not the presence of a mother and father, but the need for genetic ties.
Yeah.
And the need for sort of, because genetic ties, married mom-dad household needs less help from outside the family than constructed households.
Yeah.
Right? They just need more help if there's not a father, or if, you know, the genetic connections to the children aren't present, or if they're, you know, there's only one parent or there's four parents. I mean, it's going to be different.
I guess the right question is, smart people who are trying to deconstruct the nuclear family, when you in social science are proving that the best family formation outcome is a biological mom and dad household at every measure that I can see. I don't know if there's one that's cropped up since I've looked at the data, but you know, the elites that run the country, whether in business or politics or wherever, they just seem so unaware of what they're deconstructing. I mean, kind of the core fabric. I'll give you an example that I've never shared publicly. I was with a Supreme Court justice who's no longer on the bench. He retired. But we were talking about poverty, and he didn't entertain a lot of Christian leadership, is the inference I had. And I said, I know you expect a lot of Christian organizations to feed the hungry and feed the poor. And, you know, that's a great tradition of the church. But if focus on the family, we're trying to go right at the root cause of poverty, which is divorce. So a mother and children in marriage, I think the poverty rate at the time was like 6%. After divorce, it's like 36%. And I remember he put his hands behind his head and he said, you know, I'd never thought of it that way. That's a Supreme Court justice.
Yeah, right.
I can't imagine the university halls and classrooms and let alone Congress. Right. It almost feels moronic that they're so ill-informed about the delivery of an intact mom and dad family and what it does for the culture in the ways of stability. I mean, how do we get their attention? Or is it that blatant?
Yeah.
They don't care.
Back to what we were saying about the the ways of hiding information in some ways. I mean, you know, with data, I could do a lot of things, right? I can mask certain realities. I can highlight certain realities. So social sciences in this domain, which 30 years ago I actually thought was pretty sane, and now I think decidedly the opposite. It is sort of wed to kind of a new culture construction in some ways. So it's frustrating because there are times when I lapse into the sort of, well, you know, if the legal and political culture happened to collapse, and I don't want that to occur, what would people be kind of, what would people do, right? You would lean on your families immediately, promptly, profoundly, right? That's the only structure that would kind of endure, right? But we're in an advanced kind of political form where we think, oh, we have a problem? Well, there's a solution for that. And so I think it becomes robbing Peter to pay Paul in terms of how to fix this structural systemic problems that kind of family neglect and marriage neglect has brought about.
Yeah. I think we have a difficult challenge in the church as well, which is how do we encourage our young people that marriage is a good thing? I mean, part of that is our fault as adults who have not shown that it's a good thing. Divorce rate in the Christian community is way too high. I know that it can occur, and I get that, and there's abuse, and there's sexual infidelity, and things that the Bible certainly says it's means for divorce. Yet at the same time, there's a lot of, I just got tired of you. The graying of divorce, what you talked about earlier. So, you know, one of the things we have to do is the Christian community is to live it well. And then our children need to see that this is good, that what mom and dad have is really good. It's better than any alternative I can think of. And right now you've got young people in the church who are living together at high rates. I mean, amazingly high rates. My brother's, he's been a pastor, and he's married a few couples that have been living together for 5, 6, 7, 8 years. But now they've just decided, man, the Lord's not happy with that. We got to get married. And that's great. But I guess the question I have in this is, A, why is that occurring? Why are so many religiously convicted kids, young people, 20, 30-somethings, why are they living together mm-hmm. more than marrying? And then data supports the fact that that's not the best way to start together.
Yeah. Well, some of it has to do with the contraceptive mentality that is so popular out there. Because if they're living together, they're having a sexual relationship together. And if they're having a sexual relationship together and children aren't forthcoming, then the kind of most immediate consequence, and frankly, the most immediate sort of creative aspect of sexual relationships, is off the table. And so there's not the kind of impulse and motivation to change your status. And I think people thought, well, you know, judgment would be forthcoming. And now it's sort of like, well, your parents are irritated with you, but judgment didn't happen. So you kind of like, well, I can live with this for a while. You hid it for a while, and then you didn't have to hide it for a while. The 20s is not exactly a religious zenith. So, you know,
most people.
We'll get it in the 30s, right? We'll get it right. So, but frankly, you know, if somebody's not expecting a baby, there's no major decision that seems to have to be made by a lot of these kids, these young people. So, and that was very different than human history up to 1970-something, right? So we shouldn't be surprised that this is occurring because it was, you know, it's a technological development. So, but yeah, it's also not surprising that some of these kids feel after they've been cohabiting for a while that this is not where we ought to be.
Let me ask you this. Dr. Al Mohler, who used to be on the Focus on the Family board, and of course is president of Southern Seminary, very bright individual. One of the things he said is he's encouraging his students, marry early. Don't wait. Mm-hmm. Why are you waiting?
Yeah.
Get married, go to school. I mean, there's ways to find the financial ability to do that. But his point is even Christian parents are kind of forcing their young adult Christian children to delay sexual intimacy until they're 30.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, and he's saying that's not realistic. So you're going to end up with one or two problems. So why not support them in early courtship and marriage?
Yeah.
And in addition to that, Mark, and I'd like your response to both of these things, the other is, and I'm guilty of this too, you know, finish school, get married, have kids in that order.
Yeah.
Because social science says that's the right order. And it is.
It is a good order.
But let's do it at 20, 21, 22. You don't have to wait till you're 34, 35, 36.
Right.
And I guess that's the question now. What we are lifting up as parents to kids as what's most important.
Right. So a couple things. You have the emergence of what is called the capstone mentality of marriage, right? That kind of blew over the church, just like it blew over the rest of the culture. It isn't inherently problematic, but it has some problematic aspects to it. Like, it's
describe
it. Yeah, it's very different than sort of thinking of marriage as foundational to the adult life course. When it's foundational, you think about a foundation. It's what you start with, and you build from there, and you build it together. So when you know when you're marrying, I got married at 22. We had a stint of poverty in there.
Yeah,
we
saw not much coming, furniture, I would guess.
Saw it coming. You know, apartments. I don't even want my children living in them. But that's what we lived in, and it was functional for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it was temporary, and I was going to seek higher ed, etc. That's foundation, like that marriage is something that you can experience life together and get through some of these challenges. And I don't regret that at all. A capstone model, which is sort of, we've moved in that direction, independent of the will of people. Like, you know, when you're marrying at an average of 29, 30, you're in a capstone territory.
Meaning
that it's the icing on the cake. It's like a capstone. It's
your career is moving. Yeah, you got everything set financially.
So you think about marriage as something that you become worthy of if you do your 20s correctly, right? Rather than sort of marriage is a good thing. If I found someone who wants this sort of thing, we'll do it together and accomplish some of those things. Maybe a little later. I don't know. But you don't think about it as if I need to become worthy of being married. that's a different mentality than sort of thinking about marriage as sort of a natural institution that people move into in their early to mid-20s.
You know, Mark, I want to, you know, be objective. I'm a Christian man. I believe in marrying earlier. Gene and I married at 25, just after college. But in that context, it's almost sounding like, well, you know, I get things in order. I do the right things. Mm-hmm. I go to school. Mm-hmm. If I don't meet someone there, I'll meet somebody hopefully at my job. But I'm going to put my attention on my career and, you know, probably start my 401k. We'll have a few hundred thousand in there. And at 30, 31, you know, I got the opportunity now to get married. Right. To some people, that seems highly rational, actually.
Oh, I get it, right?
So what, you know, mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of the objective, logical son who a listener is going to have, and they're going, this is the son's point. I'm doing it the right way, Mom. Right. You and Dad didn't do it the right way.
Well, some of these things are independent of what kids wish to do, right? So if you're, say, a 26-year-old young man, like, and women aren't paying attention to you, well, you don't have a lot of option to do a foundational marriage at that point. You're kind of in that pathway. So it's a little bit about like the mentalities of what is marriage for, right? Is it kind of the anchor of the adult life course that I really need to keep my attention on? Or is it like, this, it literally is a capstone. I will do these other very important things first, and then I'll add it, right? Which is a little bit different mentality than thinking about marriage as sort of, this is sort of the heartbeat of the adult life course. And children that would come from this union are the most creative thing we could ever do as human beings, right? So again, I don't try to problematize either one necessarily. Mm. They have their strengths and weaknesses. Frankly, in a world where we coddle college students, I'm not sure the average 21-year-old or 22-year-old is ready for the responsibilities of marriage at times. But some are, and some can be, and some are raised to be, right? So
it's or not, in that context, maybe we as parents should do a better job getting them ready, is the point.
Well, certainly that. Certainly that. So I thought for sure my 23-year-old son would be doing a capstone marriage.
Right.
Just because he showed no interest in college. Some early relationships didn't pan out. And he's sort of like, I'm done with this, right? We'll think about this some other day.
Right.
He's plotting a career, et cetera. And then voila, his senior year of college, when he least expected it, he fell in love, right? And all of a sudden, that sort of it turns for him that, oh, this is a good thing. This is something that, you know, I want to be with this person. So some of it has to do with sort of what are we expecting of children? What's going on their college campuses, or if they don't go to college, what's going on in their communities? Frankly, we put too much emphasis on the college campus just because, hey, it's the best big marketplace for meeting somebody of the opposite sex. Mm-hmm. Whereas lots of kids who don't go to college, you know, they're kind of thrown into the online dating world from the get-go, which the online dating world, that exacerbates this problem significantly. I mean, that is about like, that's capstone purely, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a brutal process. Swipe right. Like, you are evaluated strictly by your looks and maybe some little social class. And we cycle through people super fast. Like, this is not the way human communities worked.
Yeah. Let me ask you, as a researcher, scientist, you know, I think of these dating sites, and one of them, you fill out a profile of yourself, and their commitment to you is to find you somebody who's compatible. And I think to myself, wow, you know, if the goal is you don't irritate me as much as somebody else, it's kind of where, you know, for Gene and I, the Lord has taught me a lot, and I still have a lot to learn, even at my age, about how Gene lovingly sands my rough edges off, if I could say it that way. Is it really about finding somebody that just won't irritate you as much and that we call that bliss? I mean, I would think as a researcher and as a Christian, that's a problem.
Yeah,
Because that's not the goal of marriage.
Right. And then outsourcing it to a computer algorithm seems ridiculous, right? I see the old school kind of
But there is desperation, too. I can think of these types. Women who are saying, yeah. I'm not meeting guys anywhere else. They're not.
And, right.
You know, yeah. So it's a tough thing.
It is a solution to a clear and obvious problem. So and it can work. And yet the system itself is designed to emphasize things that are problematic, right?
Right.
You know, a rapid evaluation on a handful of indicators. And I think about sort of a forgiving spirit. I mean, how do you measure a forgiving spirit?
Well, you're the social scientist. You tell me.
Heaven knows that if two people can't forgive one another in this, you know, unforgiving world, they're doomed.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. Let's, in the next few minutes, let's look forward. How do we move ahead? You know, I think those of us that believe in marriage, believe in the scripture that talks about marriage, certainly Christ himself talked about the metaphor of the father, the bride, and the bridegroom.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think God is really into marriage, don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when you look at all those things, you know, what is the positive messaging we should be doing? It feels like a drop in the bucket from where I sit at Focus on the Family. This culture is rapidly downstream. And to lift up the wonders of marriage and all you get back is scorn. And man, you're living in the 20th century, right?
Yeah. Well, we drop it at our peril and at our demise, frankly. This is what we do. This is what you folks do at Focus on the Family. And it is a high and noble calling. We can't take our cues from what is good and right from the world around us. So we have to be grounded. You know, I'm reminded that Jesus' first miracle was performed at a wedding. Why was he at a wedding? Why did he invite his disciples? Why was his mother there? Because, you know, he showed esteem for the institution by being present. Right? And it's recorded like this was something significant. And his mother, you know, with the social nature of marriage and weddings, was concerned by something and right. says, hey, can you do something here? Right?
I love it.
The Cana account is significant for us in ways we might overlook. So, you know, marriage is blessed by our Lord. Some people say, oh, Jesus didn't say much about marriage, and he didn't say about these modern forms of marriage. It's like, well, Jesus was talked about marriage. He talked about it in the Old Testament reference, but he also sort of showed up and esteemed it in his presence at Cana. So even though this squabble, battle, conflict, we didn't want it, right? But it's ours, it's here, and just it's so elementally important for human flourishing, for social reproduction, and frankly too for the church. I mean, the church is built more predictably and steadily on human reproduction than on evangelism, even though both of those are important.
Yeah. Let me ask you, and we're winding down here, but again, this may be an unfair question, and I don't like to get these questions either. So,
but ask it anyway.
You know, I'll ask it anyway. Looking down the line, again, as a researcher and as the foundation in your life as a believer in Christ, when you look at 2150, you know, just over 100 years from now, looking at the trends that you've studied your entire adult life, you know, family formation, ups and downs, disintegration, deconstruction of the family, the attributes, the positive attributes of family, those negative attributes that are now occurring because of the breakup of family, the impact on children. I think I'm painting the picture.
Yeah.
You look out 100 years, what kind of culture do you see?
Right. So my first thought turns to technology and, you know, what that will look like, which is very difficult to predict, of course. And you see some of the trends in which we're kind of tracking. There's an emphasis on constructing human beings in different kinds of ways. At the same time, I think, you know, we've talked about this so far. I mean, we've become fairly adept at it, and yet its uptake rate is pretty small. People will still be generating human beings with each other, male and female. And that part really won't change. We maybe get culturally better, technologically better at creating people in different ways, but the normal old way will not disappear. So go back in time as far, right?
Mm.
So let's go back to 1800 or something like
that. It's amazing.
Right? They loved their families. There was conflict, but there was also bliss. There was children. There was suffering. There was, you know, parental love for children, grandchildren. That was there. That's still here, right? There's no reason to think that we won't still value those things in the future. So in some ways, one can't know the sort of social scene, the political scene, the technological scene. But fundamentally, humans haven't changed radically, right?
Yeah.
And in this domain, there's so much generalized happiness in a flourishing marriage and with our children, raising them, loving them, watching them grow, pride about grandchildren, things like that. I don't see those things as being somehow an evolutionary fragment of the age from far in the past up to present, about to disappear in the next 150 years. I just don't see that.
Yeah. You know, another positive way to say that, and I've said this, is that God's truth is not buried forever. I mean, the culture can do lots of things to redefine, reinvent. They think they're moving in the right direction when they're going toward a dead end.
Right.
And you're right. Humanity has an amazing way of bouncing back to the fundamentals. Like you said earlier, when our backs are up against the wall, it's family that matters.
Exactly.
It's where we
come
back together. It's what becomes important to us. I don't think we'll ever lose that. Mark, this has been great. I so appreciate your experience, and thank you for sticking it out and not giving up being a social scientist at the University of Texas. I'm glad you're there and still doing the things that you do. We need talented believers in Christ to be active intellectually and to be engaged in the endeavor of vocation. So thank you for what you do.
You're welcome, Jim. I don't know what else to do, so I think I'll just keep doing it.
Okay. Well, Mark is a great example of someone who follows where the data leads him, and I would suggest where the Lord leads him to. And all truth does lead back to God's truth and his design, because God created men and women, marriage, family. Mark addressed some of the social trends like declining rates of marriage, same-sex couples parenting children, abortion, and the move away from the nuclear family, all of which have been proven to be harmful for families and society. So what should we do as believers? Should we feel defeated? Of course not. As Scripture says, we're called to be careful how we live because the days we live in are evil. Well, there's an answer, but we should also give thanks to God in everything, not some things, everything, and walk in the way of love, because Christ has redeemed us and restored us. And I think right now, especially with all the swirl in the culture, one thing that my non-believing friends are noticing is that when we as Christians are jittery, fearful, they're saying, man, we should really be worried if you, the Christians, are worried. And that's, I think, why the Lord says, fear not. I mean, he's got this. We need to be engaged. We need to be active. We need to do all we can do to persuade people that Jesus is who he said he was, that we need to embrace him, accept him as Lord and Savior, and then hopefully have a life of shalom, of peace. But in that context, fear not, because the world is going to hate you because of my name. That's what he told us. So it shouldn't come as any surprise that there will be a pushback, sometimes a fierce pushback, when we claim the truths of Scripture and our trust and faith in Christ. We have a video series to help you learn more about engaging the culture on issues like we've heard today and to respond with the truth and grace of Christ. In these videos, John Stonestreet, president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, shares how you can communicate effectively about marriage, LGBT issues, abortion, the hot topics of the day. Be sure to check that out by following the link in the episode notes. And if you're thinking about marriage and you want to make good decisions in that pursuit, we have some wonderful resources for you through our Boundless Ministry. That's a ministry for singles. Marriage is a good thing, and we want to help you build a strong marriage and aim for that. So sign up for some free resources we've designed specifically for men and women, and you'll see the link in the episode notes. Okay, for the inbox segment, here's a voicemail from Caroline.
Hey, Jim. I'm a teacher, and I've noticed that a lot of the kids that I work with who are dealing with anxiety and other mental health issues have parents who are LGBT. How do we as Christians help people realize that their choices have a negative impact on their kids?
Whew, Carolyn, this is the subject of the day. Someone I've been following, I've had her on the podcast, and my Focus on the Family broadcast is Katie Faust. She has a powerful testimony. Her mom and dad divorced at 10. And her mom ended up with a female partner who the two of them raised her. And she said, although I love them both, they deprived me of a father. So when you look at the impact of adult decision-making in this regard, where those in the LGBT community are adopting children, etc., there is an impact. By that action, they are purposefully depriving a child of both a mother and a father. And of course, biblically, we believe that's detrimental to that child's development. Now, you could look at social science. We do believe that the social science supports that component. But in the end, we are more selfish as adults today than we used to be. It used to be we looked out for children, all of us, and we made sure children were protected. The culture is no longer doing that the way we used to. Now it's about us, me-ism, what I want outweighs what's best for a child. And that is really sad for our culture. Caroline, thanks for the question. I'm glad you're representing a Christ-like attitude in your classroom. Keep it up. That will make a difference on those kids. It did for me. My high school teacher and football coach helped lead me to the Lord. So you're in a very critical spot as a teacher to influence those children just by your presence and how you carry yourself. Because I answered your question here on the podcast, I'm going to send you a copy of my book, Refocus, Living a Life That Reflects God's Heart. And my hope in that is that the book will help you to return to the example of Jesus and the power of God's grace as you live the Christian life right where you're at, no matter where you're at. And I'll encourage you to get a copy from us here at Focus on the Family. The link is in the program notes. If you have a question for me, please send me a voicemail by clicking on the link that we've provided. I want to hear about what you're encountering in the culture and how you're seeing God move in your life and those around you. Also, one way you can help spread the word is by supporting and donating to Refocus. We wouldn't be able to create this podcast and all the supporting materials without your financial support. So let us know how the podcast has helped or inspired you and donate to help us reach even more people. I really appreciate you listening to Refocus with Jim Daly. Please share the podcast with your friends and then like, listen, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. On the next episode of Refocus, Kristen Hawkins, the president of Students for Life of America, shares strategies for persuading college-age women to choose life.
In every story, every person we interviewed, the difference between life and death was one person. Yeah. Finding if she was able to find one person to tell her she didn't have to have the abortion.
That's coming up on Monday, April 8th on the next Refocus with Jim Daly. It can be challenging to inspire your community to see life the way God sees it. So what's the solution? Well, on June 15th, Focus on the Family is hosting See Life 24. And no matter where you are or who you are, you can be a part of this free event with speakers like Ben and Kirsten Watson and real stories about choosing life. See Life 24 will inspire you to translate your faith into action. Register today at seelife24.org.